This episode of Access Utah was first broadcast in September of last year.
Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Today we're going to talk with Jackson Didrikson, who's Access to Justice Program Coordinator with the Transforming Communities Institute at Utah State University. We're going to talk about the recent launch of their Community Justice Advocate Program. The CGA program was designed to expand access to justice in Utah by training and certifying social workers and other helping professionals as alternative legal providers. And they just finished training 21 social service practitioners as CGAs to provide limited scope legal services to individuals facing or at risk of debt collection lawsuits. So we want to talk about this today. Jackson Didrikson joins me in studio. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So, first of all, what is the Transforming Communities Institute?
Yeah, the Transforming Communities Institute is a small research institute in the Department of Social Work here at USU. And to sum up, our mission is to work with Utahns to co-create knowledge and solutions that address social issues across the state that matter to those communities. So, I'd say like the three major arms of TCI are community engaged research and solution building, community education and professional development. We provide a lot of continuing ed for social workers and others around the state, and then consulting and capacity building. The CJA program, it falls under that community engaged research and solution building. That's really what got me excited about joining the team at TCI, is just that, you know, I mean, academia is important, building knowledge is important, but TCI really bridges that gap of building knowledge that's going to create real solutions in the world and result in it fast. And in the process, we're also building knowledge. So it's really an awesome institute to be a part of.
So this, what we're talking about today is an example of that, right? Not just an ivory tower thing. This is hopefully affecting people's lives directly. So let's talk about the problem you're trying to address here. First of all, debt collection, right? Some of the facts I'm reading from your website: 85% of civil cases in Utah are debt collection. 4% of people have an attorney. So you can see the asymmetry there, right?
Yes, a massive asymmetry for sure. Debt claims are, like you mentioned, they make up 85% of all civil legal claims filed in the state. That comes out to be roughly 60,000 cases a year that are being filed. And it's a massive problem, especially when you consider the amount of attorneys in the state, and it becomes a bigger problem as you get into more rural counties. The vast majority of attorneys in the state are in Salt Lake County. But many folks who are getting sued in courts and are in these rural counties where there's hardly any attorneys. There's maybe 2,000 people per one attorney in their county. Tooele County is a great example of that. They, let's see, annually in 2019, they had about a 2.5% debt collection filing rate, which meant that 2.5% of the population received a lawsuit. And there's only one attorney per 2,000 people in Tooele County. So it's not that they're, I guess, there's just not enough attorneys to take these cases.
Yeah. Some other statistics here. 27% of Utah's households are cost burdened, right? Which means 30% or more income spent on housing. So 27%, that's, I imagine that's likely to rise.
For sure.
With this economy.
Yeah, we definitely probably need to get around to updating that statistic, because I'd be surprised if it hasn't risen even though it's just over the last year. And I mean, if you think about that, you're spending 30% of your take-home pay on housing. That's not including groceries. That's not including gas. That's not if you've got kids, like, that's not including any of that. That's just your mortgage or your rent, your utility bills. And then if you ask someone, the other statistic that we have on our website is an attorney in Utah on average costs about $296 an hour.
Right.
So I mean, there's a lot of people who can't afford that, who have a college education, who are in a professional field. That's no small amount of money to be spending, especially when you're already in the hole with a debt.
Right. Then, as you were outlining with Tooele County in specific, 22 of Utah's counties have less than one lawyer per 250 households. A lot of rural counties, right?
Yes.
With few attorneys.
Yes. Most of the attorneys in the state are, like I mentioned, they're concentrated in Salt Lake County and then along the Wasatch Front. And then places like Cache County or Washington County, where we're kind of a blend of rural and urban, we have a fair amount of attorneys, but it's still, once you get out into those rural counties, they're legal deserts, ultimately. Yeah.
I have a couple of friends who've faced this, debt collection. You get in trouble financially in your household. You go to a payday lender or whatever it is, right?
Mm-hmm.
Some of these are, pretty high interest rates. And then you don't pay. And then the debt collector, which is their right, comes after you.
Yep.
Right? Starts with letters in red ink could escalate from there, could go to court, right?
Yep.
But from the perspective of a person in debt, this can be pretty scary. If you go threatened with the legal system, you don't know much about it.
Absolutely. And I think this is a good time to bring up kind of the premise of this idea, kind of what the genesis of it, I guess, is that individuals who are not acknowledging these letters, because ultimately that's what happens. They don't respond. They bury their head in the sand because it's stressful. And that's what we tend to do as humans. We kind of clam up when we get overwhelmed. And the idea was that folks that are in this situation that are really struggling and feeling overwhelmed, they're already accessing services typically from a mental health professional or a social worker, a case manager, right? And so the idea was that if we train these social service providers and we train them how to identify these issues, they can provide some triage. Because a lot of time when you're getting those letters, you don't realize that you have a legal problem. You think you have a money problem, which is true, but it's also a legal problem. And it's hard to know that unless you understand how these debt collection companies work, and you understand the court process.
And if it does get taken to court, their side might have an attorney, and you probably don't, right? So there's, some of the problems come where you miss a court date.
Yep, and that's unforgivable, right?
And then you're in some legal trouble and extra financial trouble.
So, yeah, it's a very confusing process, right? I mean, after a lawsuit is filed, you might receive a complaint and a summons to appear in court. It's called a 10-day summons. That confuses people. And what that actually means is the 10 days is actually for the plaintiff, the one suing the defendant. And that means they have 10 days to actually file the complaint with the court. So people usually want to take care of it immediately. It's like if you get a parking ticket or a speeding ticket, you want to go and pay that immediately or respond immediately, but you need to wait 3 to 5 days for that ticket to be filed with the court. It's the same thing here. A lot of times people go to respond and there's no court case on file yet. And then they've got 21 days to file their response. And if they don't respond in that time frame, then it's a default judgment. The plaintiff gets whatever they want. And that's when you'll start to see wages getting garnished.
Right. Which sometimes can be a surprise to the
absolutely.
Debtor,
that's
right. Yeah.
What we found is that a lot of debtors, they don't realize that they even got sued until they see that first deduction from their paycheck.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I guess I should pause here and say there may be some in the audience saying, well, they incurred the debt. They deserve every last thing that's coming to them, right?
Absolutely. We're definitely not here. I always have to constantly reassure we're not here to necessarily forgive people of their debts, right? A lot of times, 99% of the time, these debt collection agencies are doing their job correctly. They're doing it ethically. And these people, they owe the debt. There's no question about it. I'd also say that more often than not, the people who owe the debt want to pay the debt, and they want to take responsibility. And so the idea here is not to get them out of paying that debt. The problem that is really, and I think it really behooves all of us to pay attention to it, is these debts balloon when they go to court. now suddenly they're not just paying back the original debt. They've got to pay attorney's fees for the plaintiff's side. They've got to pay court fees. In eviction cases that, I mean, ultimately they're eviction cases first, but they quickly transpire into a debt collection case. They're in Utah, you're required to pay treble damages. And that can balloon from owing $1,500 of back rent to suddenly you owe $8,000 because it went to court, right? And so the idea is to catch them early and help them pay the debt when it's more manageable, because it's never going to get more manageable if you just wait until it goes through the court.
Right. And as you said, the response sometimes is bury your head in the sand. This is very, very stressful.
Yep.
You know it's not going away. Just hope it goes away, and it doesn't go away, right? So what does a community justice advocate do? What are they authorized? Tell me about everything up to court, and then talk about court, I guess.
Yeah. So up to court, the community justice advocate can ultimately what sets this apart, I guess, is we'll back up here and give a little context. The Utah Supreme Court a few years ago established a program called the Sandbox, which is ultimately just they're piloting this idea of non-traditional legal providers providing legal services. So we received authorization through that program to train social workers, non-lawyers, to give legal advice, which typically if you're doing this, that would be illegal. Attorneys are the only ones who can give legal advice. So they're trained to spot issues in their interactions with clients, pay attention to red flags, people saying like, oh, I'm stressed. If something happened, I don't have enough savings to cover that or things like that. And to just kind of probe, ask questions and identify if there are any potential legal pitfalls ahead. When it comes to the clients actually receiving a debt collection demand letter from a plaintiff, a debt collector, so no legal action has been filed, that CJA can help them understand what the letter's demanding. A lot of times these people don't recognize the debt because coming from the debt collector, not the original creditor from where the debt was incurred. So a CJA can help them draft and send a letter requesting validation of that debt. They're entitled to certain rights under the Federal Debt Collection Practices Act, or the FDCPA. And so all debtors are entitled to those rights to know exactly what the account is. They can see the debt collector's documentation and paper trail of the debt. So, and then ultimately the goal is that the CJA will then be able to help them negotiate a settlement. Some of these debt buyers are paying pennies on the dollar for the debt. And people don't realize that they can pay a third of it, and that'll settle the account. And the debt collector is just fine with that. So they can help with the negotiation and really avoid it from going to court. When it goes to court, they can help them fill out and file court documents. So the most important one, obviously, is that answer prevents a default judgment. Helping them file initial disclosures is another deadline they've got to meet. And then sometimes the plaintiff will request certain information, and if they don't respond by a certain deadline, then that's another pitfall that leads to a default judgment. So pretty much these CJAs they're doing everything that an attorney would do except for direct representation. They're not going to sit there and address the judge and plead the case for their client. They're not going to call a debt collector on behalf of a client and negotiate directly. They're simply there to help the client better represent themselves. So,
certainly better to have somebody in your court, right? Back on the sales of these debts, that happens quite a bit. I think if you've never been in this situation, you don't realize that you incur the debt with Company A, and all of a sudden you're getting letters from Company B, which purchased the debt, right?
Absolutely. It can be extremely confusing, right? And oftentimes debt collectors, their business name doesn't really sound, they're not familiar, right? You're getting a letter from Express Recovery Services and it's just all they're going to tell you, because and this is part of the FDCPA, they're going to leave you a limited content message that will basically say, hi, this is so-and-so. I'm reaching out to Jackson and please give me a call back. I have a matter to discuss with you. And that's to protect the debtor's privacy in case if anyone else is privy to hearing that voicemail. But a lot of times people are just like, I mean, we live in a day, right, where there's a lot of phone scams going around. And so you could understand why somebody might ignore that call. But then a lot of times, too, they don't recognize the name. They remember that dental bill or they remember that medical bill, but they don't. Why isn't the dentist calling, right?
Yeah, yeah. Well, that gets into the reasons for and why this might be expanding. Housing is a big one, right? Mm-hmm. Medical expenses.
Absolutely.
As well, right? And probably just going to get worse before it gets better. I'm wondering, did any pushback at all from debt collectors? Hey, these people now have representation that's going to cut into I don't know, have you heard anything?
Yes. So, I mean, part of what makes, I'm glad that you brought that up. Part of what makes the Transforming Communities Institute so special is that our process is so engaged that we invite debt collectors to come in and actually weigh in on how we design the program. And so for each project that TCI does, we have a community partner panel. You can think about this as like a steering committee or an advisory board. And so on the CJA program panel, community partner panel, we have two debt collectors sitting on that panel. And we've received a little bit of pushback from especially some of the individuals that are really advocating for debtor rights and really advocating for this program. And, you know, our perspective is, well, if this is going to be a sustainable solution, we need to build a solution that is beneficial for not only the individual being sued, but also for the plaintiff, because right, they're legally entitled to that money. And the way that we've designed this program is really to be, I know that these things are pretty rare in life, but I ultimately see it as a win-win, because in its current state, a lot of these debt collectors, they're not getting anything, right? Like, you can garnish wages, but that costs a lot of money. For people's times, hiring attorneys, right? That's an expensive process. They would much rather not have to file lawsuits. They would much rather have an individual who's willing to come to the table, to talk, to negotiate, and to agree upon a payment plan or something that's going to work and be reliable. And I can also assure you that it's the same thing with, you know, the hospital or the credit card company. They would much rather have work with the individual for something that's going to work with their situation. And then you think about the long-term impacts. If that leads to someone being able to keep their car and then they can still get to work, I mean, the economic benefits, right, that could, you know, it's like a butterfly effect. It can ripple and cause a lot of economic benefits that I think all of us would be interested in.
Interesting. And then I had the same question about attorneys, but then I noticed you had attorneys on your advisory board. You know, I guess attorneys realize there are not enough of us to go around, and they're not necessarily losing business, I'm guessing.
No, definitely not losing business. You don't have to be too knowledgeable about debt collection to know that the money is on the side that's collecting, not the side that needs to pay up, right? And so it's just the way that it's set up. Attorneys are, I mean, I guess I'll back up. One thing that when we speak with some attorneys who aren't super familiar with the program, they haven't been involved, they worry about our intentions. And our intentions are absolutely not to replace attorneys. You can't replace attorneys with a 10-week online asynchronous course, right? Like, that doesn't replace law school. So we're not training these CJAs to be as competent as an attorney. We've actually actively trained them to be like, if the conversation starts going into bankruptcy, feel free to share some general legal information about bankruptcy, but then that's when it's kind of outside your scope and it's time to refer them to legal counsel. So we're training these individuals to be very specific, targeted service, right? They're not replacing attorneys. They're they're really there just to make the system a little more balanced.
Yeah. Before we go to break, might be people listening saying, hey, I'm a debtor. I'd like to get connected. So how do people get connected?
Yeah, you know, that's a great question. And I wish I could say, you know, go to this website, call this number. We're ready for you. We'll help you out. The hang up that we're at right now is our authorization order. The way that we modeled this was, I guess we're required to offer these services free of charge, which is great. Fantastic. I mean, is it really going to improve access to justice if the free market takes over and it causes, you know, suddenly a CJA is now charging $150 an hour? Well, that's a little more affordable, but still not great. So they're required to offer these services free of charge. And the original model was that we had several case managers, social workers, and therapists who came in, and they're earning the certification as an extension of their role. Now, if you're a therapist in private practice, obviously you have a little more flexibility in who you can offer the service to. Whereas if you're for example, we have a few practitioners at the Bear River Association of Governments, our community action agency up here in the Bear River region, you've got to meet certain requirements to qualify for services through BRAG. And so they're limited in who they can help to their existing clientele. So that's a little bit of a bottleneck. We kind of last minute decided to experiment with what we're calling standalone CJAs. And so they're offering, as volunteers, they're offering services through Nonprofit Legal Services of Utah, our partner who's providing attorney supervision and whatnot. And that is open to the public, right? You can go to our website and see the CJAs who have been certified. And we're currently working on developing a self-referral process. And that process will allow you to get connected to a volunteer CJA who can hopefully help you out. So,
okay. So the nonprofit attorney, you contact them. What are they again?
Yeah, Nonprofit Legal Services of Utah.
Nonprofit Legal Services, yeah. And I guess your local government agency like BRAG in here in northern Utah, you could contact them.
See if you qualify.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, good. Are you going to expand this? You got 21 right now. You going to expand?
Yeah. 21 is a drop in the bucket for sure with how large of an issue it is. So the plan is to train another cohort starting in January and then to train three cohorts annually of 25. So we're looking to put out about 75 CJAs a year. And then there's other organizations across the state who are also developing similar models and working in that space. And we're trying to collaborate with them as well to see if we can, you know, I mean, with a high tide, all ships are going to rise. So, we need a lot more for sure.
Well, let's go to break. We're talking with Jackson Didrikson. He is Access to Justice Program Coordinator with the Transforming Communities Institute at Utah State University. We're talking about the recent launch of the Community Justice Advocate Program, and we'll talk more about it following this break. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking about a new program, a Community Justice Advocate Program. It's being instituted by the Transforming Communities Institute at Utah State University, and we're talking with Jackson Didrikson, who's Access to Justice Program Coordinator with the TCI. Let's talk a bit about how maybe people are interested in becoming a Community Justice Advocate. What you just graduated, I guess you'd say, that this certificate, is it, that you get? 21. So the initial 21, if a person's interested, how do they go about it?
Yeah. So, I mean, right now it's a non-credit certificate program for existing professionals. So for those of the listeners who might be students at USU right now, we are working very hard to develop a four-credit option to maintain, I guess you could say, a steady pipeline of CJAs. But if you are a professional and you're encountering clients who are facing financial problems, it doesn't even have to be that you know about any legal problems. If you think they're having financial problems, this is a great program for you. I actually was talking with a local business owner, and We hadn't even thought about this, but it could even be a great opportunity for HR professionals who are, your employees are being garnished. I mean, great. Provide those services in-house and help your employees get into better situations. So if you're interested, you can visit our website at cja.usu.edu, and you'll be taken to the program homepage, and you'll see our certificate offerings. Currently, it's obviously just the one in debt collection, and you can click there and learn more, and that'll show you all the application details, the kind of the course requirements, curriculum, how much time is this going to take. We are authorized to award continuing education units, so you'll receive CEUs for completing the program. Applications for that January cohort that I was talking about, starting with spring semester, will open on October 1st. So those will be open on October 1st and run through December 15th. So,
all right. This is about 40 hours of classroom time, asynchronous. You can go at your own pace, I guess.
Yeah, so we do it's a kind of a asynchronous-synchronous blend. Each module, there's five modules in the course. It runs for 10 weeks. For each module is 2 weeks. So you have 1 week that's asynchronous. You're working self-paced on your own time through online material of readings, videos, and things like that. And then that second week, we meet one day of the week for a couple hours on Zoom, and we have some live instruction, and it's more of a scenario in which you can kind of see this, these skills that you're learning put into practice. You can ask questions. We'll have volunteer experts present to offer feedback and advice. And then you wrap up that week with a case study practice example in which you're putting your knowledge to the test. You're practicing in kind of a simulated scenario, and then we have attorneys who will then offer feedback on that written work.
So the initially it's you know, helping debtors, big need there. Where do you think this program might go in the future? What are the needs are we seeing out there? I noticed on your website people can respond. What programs should we offer?
Absolutely, yes. Because once again, we're so focused on, we don't want to build solutions just for the sake of building solutions. We want to build solutions that are in, like, we're in need of those solutions. We want to build solutions that are important to members of our Utah community. So on our website, right, you can suggest a legal practice area to which we will expand. From the feedback that we've gotten, we want to expand to victim advocacy and support services. Think about restraining orders and stalking injunctions. Those can be confusing in their own right. But when you're going through that kind of trauma and difficult stage in your life, you're already working with a victim advocate or a trained professional who's there providing you support. What better option than for them to also be able to provide you support with those legal questions and procedures? So that's kind of the area we're looking to expand to next. We've gotten tons of feedback about family law, landlord-tenant law, right? Like, just there's so many areas where the social issues are crossing over into legal issues that we want to expand to.
Yeah, I can see this model working in those areas as well. And again, you can go to cja.usu.edu and make your own suggestion, right?
Yep.
That's where you can also apply to become a CGA, right?
Yes.
I want to talk, move on to talking a little bit about the judicial sandbox. I don't know how wide your knowledge is of this. I'm a little bit aware, but I understand this is only in Utah.
Yes.
That this is happening. I guess this is to encourage experimentation. How can we expand legal services, right?
Absolutely. The Utah Supreme Court, to their credit, they noticed the need, and they decided to do what is really a scary thing and be the first state in the country to really go beyond kind of semi-adopting a model like this. It's happened in Alaska a little bit, but Utah has been the first state to really just jump headfirst into the water. And, I mean, it's definitely in a controlled manner, but kind of open the door for non-legal professionals and even just legal innovators using technology to expand access to justice, to come in a way that they're protected from, you know, the malpractice of law and those consequences, and they can, or the unauthorized practice of law, and they can experiment, because there's a problem, and the only way to solve a problem is to innovate and adapt and come up with a solution.
Mm. So I guess the way the sandbox works, this is totally uninformed, I'm guessing here. You come in with an idea. This has to get authorized to kind of experiment, but you're under the umbrella of protection of the Utah Supreme Court, I guess, while you're experimenting.
Exactly. So the Utah Supreme Court, it's actually, you can read the order. It's standing order number 15. That is the order that established the sandbox. In conjunction with that, it established what's called the Office of Legal Services Innovation. They're kind of administering and overseeing the sandbox. And then it also established the Legal Services Innovation Committee, which is a committee of volunteers who you could think of as the governing board. The office and committee, they make recommendations to the Supreme Court based on the information that they're collecting from entities that are authorized in the sandbox. But to be authorized, right, we went through a pretty rigorous application process. Well-intentioned, I guess, right? Like, it's good that they're asking for that much information. But we went through that application process and proposed the solution. And it was about, admittedly, we went to the sandbox at a time that they were kind of restructuring some of their requirements. But so it took about 8 or 9 months for us to get approval. It was about a year-long process from, year-and-a-half-long process from concept of idea to actually launching the program.
Mm.
But we report monthly to the sandbox, the Office of Innovation Services, and we just report on some of our service data, and they're really just monitoring to make sure that our services are causing more benefit than harm.
Yeah.
In this type of work with debt collection, the margin for error is very wide. It's not very likely that you're going to cause a lot of harm in these kinds of cases.
Right. So obviously your program that got authorized through the sandbox, you mentioned new technologies and legal services, I guess. Anything else you're aware of that's kind of being, I guess the sandbox leads me to the word play. It's not really play, but experimenting, right?
In
the sandbox.
You could think about it kind of from an IT perspective with web development. It's like this is kind of a sandbox environment that we're experimenting in. One example of innovation in tech that I think is amazing is RASA Legal is another sandbox authorized entity, and they're providing expungement services to expunge criminal records. Because once that's on your record, it's really hard to get a job, hard to get housing, things like that. So they have an amazing intake process that is all digital. You can literally go to their website on your phone and start filling out these forms, and it'll scrub public record, or I don't know exactly how the process works. I don't want to speak to it too much, but it's very slick, very user-friendly. And we're actually partnering with RASA to some of those individuals trying to expunge their records. They have a court fee from 1994 or something that has just been sitting there that they had no clue they had to pay. And that's the thing that's holding them up from getting their record expunged. So we're going to get them connected with CJAs to help them get those debts taken care of.
All right. Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. That sounds like a great program, the Judicial Sandbox. Before we go to break, do you have any stories about people debtors helped? This is early, right?
Yes.
You just certified your first 21, but debtors helped or CGAs that have had good experiences?
Yeah. You know, I want to actually just read one of our CGAs wrote this up. She was helping a client, and obviously she's changed identifying details here, but I'm just going to read through this because it's really awesome to hear. She writes, "My most recent client, John, is in his 70s and suffered a major medical emergency that left him with a hefty pile of medical bills. During his long road to recovery, John struggled to pay his mounting bills and found it difficult to make ends meet. He found himself living mostly off of Social Security payments as it was difficult for him to continue working with his injury as a real estate agent in Utah's already slow housing market. Despite his challenging circumstances, John spoke with enthusiasm and gratitude the first time we talked on the phone. He expressed deep appreciation for the opportunity to have an advocate who could not only help him to understand the recent court summons he had received and how to respond, but who could also walk him through the process of how he could contact his creditors to seek settlements and arrange for reasonable monthly payment plans that he could manage with confidence. Just days after helping John craft his first letter seeking a settlement, he called me to report that the creditors were willing and even eager to drop their lawsuit for the $13,000 he owed. Instead, they worked with him on creating a feasible plan for repayment. It was incredibly satisfying to see the enormous dividends generated by arming John with simple yet solid information, information that allowed him to effectively and confidently navigate an otherwise seemingly complex and scary legal system. Just as John was so full of gratitude for my help as a CJA, I too am grateful for the CJA program that armed me with the knowledge and skills needed to make a real difference in the lives of real people like John. So, I mean, it's just, it's so awesome. I mean, it's just awesome to hear, right? Like, that's why we worked super hard for a couple years with really nothing to show for it. And now just kind of getting these preliminary stories coming from our most recent cohort of CJAs, it's been really awesome to hear that. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, they're out there. They're making a real difference. So,
yeah. Let's go to another break. We're talking with Jackson Didrikson, Access to Justice Program Coordinator with the Transforming Communities Institute at USU. We're talking about the Community Justice Advocate Program, which recently launched. They finished the training their first 21 social service practitioners. We're talking about that and related topics on the program today. More following this break. You're listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking about the Community Justice Advocate Program. They are launching their first program, helping debtors. And we're talking with Jackson Didrikson, Access to Justice Program Coordinator for the Transforming Communities Institute at USU. That's where this Community Justice Advocate Program is housed. For a few minutes here at the end, Jackson, I want to talk about your background. Kind of illustrates twists and turns that backgrounds all of our backgrounds take, and undergraduate research, which is a great opportunity. So you started out wanting to be an accountant.
Yep, that's when I got up to USU in the fall semester of 2019. That's what I wanted to do, and you know I like numbers. They're still definitely a part of my personality that loves that, and I mean I guess that makes sense with me running a program that involves things like that. But I think it was, and I've talked to other accountants and they said, oh, MIS, Management Information Systems, that has nothing to do with accounting. It's not nothing, but it's not the whole deal. But I went to two classes of that and just kind of started thinking like, this isn't really what I want to do. That day actually in that class, I remember walking across campus to the education building and meeting with a psychology advisor. Got started in some intro psychology classes, and then after talking a little bit more with a professor and just other individuals on campus, I decided to go and talk to the social work advisor and fell in love with kind of the path, and that's what I pursued. So I got my undergraduate degree in social work.
What were you going to do with social work? What attracted you?
I think like many up-and-coming social workers, what attracts you is just this desire to help people. My favorite professional value of the social work profession, we have a code of ethics that has ethical values and principles, and one of the highlighting core values for me and what attracted me to the profession was that we believe in the inherent dignity and worth of people, that every individual has inherent dignity and worth. And so it attracted me in that way, and that I just wanted to sit in those moments with people and be able to help them in one-on-one situations. And obviously my initial desires to get into social work were built upon and transformed and changed. And luckily in social work, we have this professional model where we can engage in that exact same helping process in an individual setting, or we can do it at a broader setting. And that's ultimately the path I chose to take was into what we call macro practice, where your client is a large system or a state, for example, and you're implementing wider sweeping solutions. So,
Now, undergraduate research, I think, was important for you. People may not know that, you know, professors, of course, do research, graduate students, but undergraduate research.
Yes. That's what really caused the change from me wanting to become a caseworker or an individual level service provider was I was in a nonprofit management course with Dr. Jamie Walters, who is the director of the Transforming Communities Institute, and I was learning about nonprofit structures and kind of just was interested. As part of that class, we had to come up with our own kind of learning project, and I decided, you know, I'm interested in how executive directors get along with their nonprofit boards, and presented that to her, and she said, oh, this could be a research study. And I thought, huh, I didn't know as an undergraduate that I could do a research study. And so we went through that together. She mentored me, and that's kind of how I caught the bug and fell in love with studying kind of broader topics and then also being able to translate those into the real world.
Yeah. That led you to the current position. You graduated with your master's and then almost immediately. To this position. Yeah, that's great.
Yep. I graduated with my master's in May of 2024 on Friday. And I started in this position on a Monday. Because of that relationship that I built with Dr. Walters, she came to me and said, hey, there's this cool new project that a district court judge has come to us and a foundation director, and they're talking about debt collection and maybe training social workers. And she's like, would you like to be a graduate research assistant and help me in producing this program? And I thought, that sounds cool. I was kind of stressed at the time, weighed down with classes, but I was like, you know what? It sounds pretty awesome. So I took that, and then the rest is history, right? That I've been involved with helping develop this program from the beginning, and finished up my master's and then jumped right in.
Yeah, it sounds very worthwhile. Well, we reached the end of our time here. We've been talking with Jackson Didrikson, Access to Justice Program Coordinator with the Transforming Communities Institute at USU. We've been talking about their Community Justice Advocate Program, which has just launched. So where best to find out about the CGA program?
Yep. You can learn more about the CJA program at cja.usu.edu. I also would encourage listeners to visit our institute's website, which is at tci.usu.edu. That's the Transforming Communities Institute. The CJA program is just one of many programs and solutions that we're working on. So exciting work that we're doing over there.
All right. Well, thanks for telling us about this. Appreciate it.
Yes. Thanks for having me.
And thanks, everyone, for listening to Access Utah.